Thanks again to everybody that's read. It's helped us open the meeting. Take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Big welcome to any visitors with us this evening. Warm welcome to those that are coming that we haven't seen for a while. I'm really glad to see you here. A huge and massive welcome to any newcomers that might be with us tonight. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we are a speaker meeting, and it falls to me to introduce our speaker tonight. And this is a person I've known a long time. In fact, the first time I encountered this individual was the first ever online meeting I ever attended. I can't remember, it was 2009-ish, I think. They'd already been doing service online before I was. Kind of almost a newcomer, really. I was in bits in my life, all kinds of stuff going on, and reached out and found recovery in this amazing place that we called cyberspace and virtual NA. We've become great friends. We actually shared a sponsor for a short while until things got difficult, and I've actually been sponsoring this person for a number of years now, and they've become my friend, and we are great friends. We don't talk as much as I would like to these days, but we're both busy people. But she's also one of the co-founders of this group. So I'm celebrating a milestone in recovery today. So I'm going to just leave it at that and let her tell you her story, her journey to, through, and into Narcotics Anonymous. So Debs, the floor is yours. Please share with us your experience, friends, and home. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. That's I'm nearly in tears, I have to say, and indeed, and back at you. My name is Debs, and I'm a very grateful recovering addict.
Hi, Debs.
Hi, Debs.
Before I say anything else, a season's greetings to you all. And as Steve quite rightly said, he was quite moving, my dear. I'm touched. As Steve has said, I celebrate a milestone birthday today. The journey began 14 years ago today, when about 100 yards down the garden from where I'm sat now, I collapsed. My heart flipped, did something silly. And I was singularly fortunate that day in that... firstly, God had other plans. Secondly, my mother was a nurse. And thirdly, about 20 yards from where my parents' old house is, which is where my sister now lives, there is a doctor's surgery, and the paramedic was having his lunch. And things moved very, very quickly. And that was my rock bottom. It had been 14 years, Christmas Eve, since my last drink. I'm an alcoholic. That is my drug of choice, alcohol. And of course, that's where my journey starts. But the story goes back way before then. It goes back, you know, if I go back to the very beginning, what I've learned, one of many, many lessons I've learned since I've been in recovery, is that this invariably is a lifelong thing. You have to go so far back, trace the origins, I think, of your disease, that it took me quite some time to do it. For many years, I was one of these people, and there are millions of people out there, the same as I was, that thought addiction was for people who lived in gutters, drank out of brown paper bags, and the general low lives in life, because that is the ways that society had educated me or formed and shaped my views on that particular issue. And it's true, you know, addiction is still a very much overlooked disease. And I think we all know that anyway. But so many lessons have been learned. And I guess that's sharing is not something I'm that great with. But anyway, let's go back to the beginning. I've always suffered, the more I look back, I've always suffered with quite bad anxiety. And it took me a long while to realize that that is actually the root cause of all my problems. There is invariably a reason why we use. I've learned that a very long time ago through sponsoring and God knows what else. And for me, really, it's anxiety. And I guess the fact that my dad's never been at home. He's here. He's here now. He retired and he's a very old man now, sat in the living room. But for him, money was his God. And he's ambitious and very successful. And as a family, we paid a price for that. And when he used to come home at weekends, I used to go out drinking with him because it was the only way I could get to see him. Without going into the machinations and the ins and outs. But for a long while before addiction floored me, I've lived with a family of heavy drinkers. You know, my parents were all very heavy drinkers. My grandmother was an alcoholic, and she battled it. You know, she in the 70s got clean for about 12, 13 years. And just before, well, she went to see the doctor actually, and the doctor turned around and told her one wouldn't kill her. It was 18 months later she was dead. So that's one of the most ridiculous pieces of advice she was ever given in her life. But she died when I was about 21. And a lot of people started dying in my life around that time, and quite a lot of them in my family was liver-related diseases, you know, because they'd all drank. That's what they did. They were working class people. They weren't at work, they were at home having dinner. If they weren't at home having dinner, they were down the pub. The men, as simple as that. And that's how it was. I was brought up surrounded by alcohol. It doesn't appear to have affected my sister, but quite clearly it affected me. And this, you know, I knew well into my 20s that I had a problem with alcohol. I knew that I shouldn't be drinking as much as I was. I knew that I shouldn't be waking up feeling how I was feeling in the morning. And I was a functioning alcoholic, ostensibly. I had a very high powered, very, well, not high powered so much as high pressured job. And I earned good money. But it was a tough job. I was a commodities trader for onions and potatoes and a sales rep for agricultural software when it was going great guns. And I basically ran my own business doing that and made a lot of money. But I was working 18, 19 hours a day, 7 days a week. And when we weren't working, there was a whole gang of us doing the same sort of stuff. We were drinking, you know, it was very much a champagne styled lifestyle, high stakes and high fun. And I knew it was taking its toll on me, but I didn't really know what to do about it. And because everybody else around me was doing it, I thought it was normal and just part of a period of my life that I was going through, and that at some point it would sort itself out. I mean, let's face it, at the end of the day, I wasn't going to end up being an alcoholic because that was for people that sat in gutters with brown paper bags. Of course it was. That's what I assumed it was. That's what I'd, you know, society had conditioned me to believe it was. And things really escalated for me when I was about 35. Some friends of mine bought a pub, oddly. In Cumbria, and I went up there to see them, and I met my partner Nigel, who's not an addict, and I'm still with Nigel. So basically, I gave everything up and moved up to Cumbria, and so I went from a really high-pressured, high-powered lifestyle to doing nothing, because I had to start all over again. And it wasn't that easy, you know, the farming situation in Cumbria is completely different to the farming situation in the Fens. And so I found it very difficult. And at that point, I began to drink more and more and more. I miscarried several times as well during the first 6 or 7 years of meeting Nigel, which was a painful process. Lost a lot more people that I loved. And began to quickly realise that I was in a mess. and as did my parents. And to cut a long story short, really, to get to the nitty-gritty of it, they booked me for a fortnight in rehab. And that, I guess, is for me where the journey began. Because it was a priory, I think, rehab I went to in Nottingham 2 weeks in, and they guaranteed 100% success rate. Well, of course you do. You lock people up for 2 weeks. They've got no access to alcohol, and they leave clean. That's 100% success rate. But as we all know, that is not 100% success rate at all. It doesn't work like that. And I sat down as a businesswoman, and whilst I was in there, and watched these people and looked at this model of recovery, which to me personally was fundamentally flawed. It really is. But I learned, I took two things away from it. I came out within 2 weeks, I was using it again. But I took two things away from it. Because I was an alcoholic, they automatically sent me after the first week, and I'd been a good girl, to AA meetings, because that's where alcoholics go. And I hated it. I just couldn't believe that perhaps it was just the particular meeting, but I couldn't believe that anyone would seriously expect me to stay clean with people like this. There was that attitude. There were a lot of old guys there, and I just, oh Jesus Christ, this is never ever going to work. And a pal of mine in recovery said to me, "Do you know what? Just ask them to send you to an NA meeting with us instead. Just tell them you want to give it a go." And I said, "What the hell's NA?" And she said, "Well, it's Narcotics Anonymous. This is you need to be there." I said, "Well, I don't do narcotics. I do drink." She said, "Yeah, but drunks are welcome at Narcotics Anonymous. You'll be fine. Just tell them you want to come." So I had a word with the powers that be at this rehab, and said, "Look, this AA isn't working for me. It's not going to float my boat. And I'm a paying customer here, so at the end of the day, you have some fucking leeway. I want to try AA, NA, sorry. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. I've got nothing against AA. It's a great thing, and it helps millions of people globally. Best of luck to it, but it wasn't helping me. So I went off to this NA meeting in Nottingham, which was heaving. And it absolutely blew me apart. This place was full of people who were instantly told by my pal Lynn here, because she was a regular there. "This is my mate Deb. She's an alcoholic, but she's coming in." "Oh, great, Debs, come on in. How are you doing? And welcome. And this is the place to be." And they started giving me their phone numbers and stuff like that. And for the first time in my entire life, I felt like I belonged somewhere. And I can remember sitting in this meeting. It was packed. It was a central Nottingham meeting. It was one of the three face-to-face meetings I've been to in my life. And it was absolutely heaving. And I remember listening to people share, and I was absolutely engrossed. Within an hour, it had ended, and it could have gone on for hours for me. But at the end of it, they did the clean time countdown. And we got to the bit where people pick up the white chip, and Lynn literally grabbed my hand and shoved it in the air and said, "Deb, you need to pick up a chip. Pick up a chip, Debs." And so my hand went up, and they all gave me a clap, and I went to the front, and I said, "Shit, we've got no white chips left." This old guy sat there, and I'd been talking to him earlier, and he looked at me. He got his key ring out, and he took off the most battered white chip I've still got it, but battered white chip I've ever seen in my life, and he gave it to me. He said, "Here, have mine." And he just looked at me. And he said, "Good luck." And I couldn't believe it. It was such a massive thing for me then that somebody would want to give me a battered old piece of plastic, something that had clearly they clearly treasured, and they felt confident enough giving it to me. And I've still got it. It's still in a drawer at home, along with various other key tags I've picked up along the way. For the first time in my life, I felt. Actually felt like I belonged somewhere. I felt like I was with people who were on my wavelength and who would begin, if I gave them time, to understand the complex, deeply complex person that Deborah Steadman was and still is. And I went back to the rehab centre, and I said, you know, that was it. That's for me. That's what I need to do. And we sat down and we started to do the other thing. We started to do was step work, and they just gave me two sheets of two big wadges of paper and said, you need to get step three done by the time you leave here. And walked away. So I sat with a couple of people and said, Jim, what the fuck are steps? And I said, oh, Debs, you know, just tick the boxes and just write something down and you'll pass and they'll let you go home. And I can remember reading step one, thinking, not much of this actually really makes any sense to me. And this is no way to go about teaching people how to completely change their lives. But I can remember reading, we admitted we were powerless and our lives had become unmanageable. And it struck me then, even then, with no knowledge whatsoever really of what was going to lie ahead of me, that if I didn't get that was the building block, that was the foundation. And I knew because I've erected enough bloody sheds in my time that if you do not put the foundation in right, if you don't fully understand that you are completely and utterly under the mercy and the power of your disease, then you'll just keep coming back. You'll never get it right. And it was fundamentally important to me to really grasp that and understand it. So I ticked the boxes and I got the badge and got out clean. And when I left, I'd said to the guys there, you know, I need to find an NA meeting near me. Oops. You live in the middle of nowhere in Cumbria. We actually worked out that AA wise and recovery wise, where I live was actually more remote than where Steve was living on the Outer Hebrides at the time, and believe it or not. And there was nothing. So the guy, I can remember the guy at the rehab saying, well, I don't know what you're going to do, you're knackered. And I thought, you know, I was getting really kind of ramped up about, yeah, if I can get to another one of these NA meetings and it's half as good as this thing in Nottingham was, I think I could crack this, you know, I could really make a new life for myself, and boom, I hit the deck. So I got home and the inevitable happened because there was nothing, there was no support, and their advice to me was to move. Well, you don't move a farm that's been sat there for 500 odd years and God knows how many sheep and God knows what else, just because it's not close enough to a recovery meeting. It just doesn't happen. I'm a farmer by trade. I kind of dipped in and out of trying to stop using for a while. And I did find online meetings, because internet is something that I'd been working with for donkey's years. So I knew it was there and I knew how to work it. I started doing a bit of research and I found these little old NA meetings, and I actually found NA UK or whatever it was. And I think there was two meetings, two nights a week there, and I dipped in and out, but I'd lost my mojo, you know, and it just wasn't working for me. And I knew, you know, I'm an all or nothing kind of person. I'm either riding along on the crest of a wave, I'm sinking at the bottom of the ocean. There's never any middle ground, and that kind of comes back to the anxiety issue, I guess. But I knew that I had to hit rock bottom. And at this point, my dad had gone into hospital to fight bowel cancer, and he had a successful bowel cancer operation. He's got liver cancer as well, but that was dormant. And then he contracted E. coli, sepsis, MRSA, and C. diff. And he's still alive. He's still sat in the sitting room. But our lives turned into one of absolute living fucking hell. We were just lived in an intensive care unit with him for, I don't know, 6 months. I've had more cups of tea sat with a vicar during that period. I've watched him go down to theatre for life-saving ops and be told that he wouldn't come back, and he did. I don't know how I got through that time, but I do remember standing at his bedside once, looking at him. You couldn't get close. You couldn't get that close to him because every organ in his body was being worked by a machine. And I can remember standing there and thinking, I don't know how I'm. I don't know how I'm stood here. I don't know how I'm upright. And that was when my, I then began to realize that there was a power at work in my life stronger than me. And it was that power that was keeping me upright and forcing me forward. And I had to hold on to it. I had to believe in it because that was all I'd got. And during this time as well, we lost another child. I miscarried again, and the hospital, Leicester, actually dealt with it for me. I sat with Dad one day, and his nurse, Ricky, he was called, was a cracking, absolute cracking lad. And he just came and put his arm around me one day. He said, "We're not just here for him, we're here for you." And I just stopped. And I said, I'm in the middle of a miscarriage. I'm losing a baby. I know I am." And he said, "Have you seen it?" I said, "How can I go for treatment when?" He says, "Right, come with me." And he got me down to the other end of the hospital, and they sorted things out for me. And that was the compassion that was, that was living in intensive care. Everything was just dealt with, and they were absolutely brilliant. But I was pretty much at my rock bottom then, but I still couldn't stop drinking. And we got Dad home. He went back in for his. He came round. We had to teach him how to walk and speak and do everything again. And he battled. He is one hell of a warrior. He's never stopped fighting. And I just wished that time that I had a fraction of his strength. But then I went through a process when he was first at home of. Well, hang on. I'm going ahead of myself. He came home in September. He's been home September time, I think he came home. And this was 14 years ago. And Christmas, I collapsed. Christmas dinner. My body just said, enough. And I bounced down to the bottom, the very, very bottom of my own personal hell. And I knew I couldn't go any deeper. We were having lunch. I apparently got up. We were sat at the very same table we sat at today, actually. I got up and I said, "I'm just going to get a glass of water. I don't feel very well." And that's the last thing I can remember. Apparently, I did quite a spectacular pirouette. Smashed my head on the way down on a radiator. And woke up in this kind of critical care unit in Nottingham. And this guy said to me, "You've been a very lucky, you are an incredibly lucky woman." He said, "For the fact that your mother was a nurse, she knew what to start doing. My sister literally rang the 999, and that would go through to our surgeon. The paramedic was in there, so he came over and just put a massive shot of adrenaline in me. I can vaguely remember that going in, and then being shunted out of the house into an ambulance, and off we went. And this guy said to me, "There's very little we can do for you here." He said, "Because we are a critical care unit, we don't, you need to go into a specialist unit." He said, "But I'm going to tell you now." He said, "You're 40 in 3 weeks' time." He said, "And if you don't stop drinking now," he said, "you won't see Easter." He said, "Your liver function is unregisterable. It's so shot to shit." And that was it. That was what I needed. I needed that. I've never touched alcohol since. And I came out the day after Boxing Day and came home, and the journey began. And I went back to my, we went back to Cumbria, and I got back into my NA meetings because that was all I had. And I got a great doctor, and she helped me. And I had two or three fabulous first years in recovery. There was a lot of pain. I went through a period of utter loathing of my father because I blamed him because he was a big drinker. And I can remember standing at the bottom of his bed one day at home and talking to him, and he was lecturing me about something. I remember my mother just looking at me, shaking her head, and I just went out the room and she said, "Don't." She said, "Please don't, because you will kill him." And she knew that if he had been a fit and healthy man, him and I would have fell out that day, and we would probably never ever have spoken again, because there was so much anger and so much hatred in me. It was unbelievable. I blamed him. I blamed everybody except myself, because he'd left me when I was a child. He'd shunted me from school to school, and I'd constantly been bullied. And he'd If I wanted to see him, you know, we used to wait up for him on a Friday night. He used to go to the pub first, then come home to see the kids. If I wanted to see him at the weekends, I had to go to the pub with him. And I idolized this man. I worshipped the ground he walked on. And at that point, during that phase, when I stood at the bottom of the bed, the whole dynamics of our relationship changed, and for the better. I walked away and I had to figure it out for myself. Because my mother was right. If I'd have, you know, if me and him had gone for it, he was so weak and so frail, I would have killed him. It would have broken his heart. He'd have died of a broken heart. I'd have said things that he just would never have gotten over. And he's a very strong man, but he couldn't handle it then. So I had to go away and I had to work it out for myself. And I had to learn for myself that this wasn't his fault. It wasn't my mother's, it wasn't my grandmother's, it wasn't my grandfather's or anybody else's. It was my fault. It was my problem, and I'd got to deal with it. And I went through to step four, actually. And then I paused steps for a long while, and I kept going back over and over them because I kept going back to step one. We admitted we were powerless and that our lives had become unmanageable. And my life had become unmanageable, you know, and I had to grasp that. I remember getting up one morning about 4 o'clock, desperately needing for a drink and rummaging around in the washing machine to find the vodka bottle. Fuck me. What is going on, eh, Debs? And I had to do it. And I just knew that I was powerless. And all this stuff kept tumbling out and coming back. And I had to unwrap each little nugget and deal with it and pack it up and kick it. Kick it out the window because I've dealt with it forever. And it was a slow, for me, it was a slow and often painful process. But I came out the other end, a better person for it. And when I'd done that, when I'd done it through my first four steps, which was just, you know, it's just how it happened to work for me, I started to be able to move forward with my recovery. And after about a year or so of going through this very painful process, the lovely guys at NA UK messaged me and said, "Would you like to do some service? You know, we've been watching you share, and people have been asking you to sponsor them." And I was very wary about doing things like that to Year Clean, but we'd like you to do some service. And I relished it. You know, I clung to these meetings. It was all I got. So I stepped up and I did. I don't know, 4 nights a bloody week I was doing service, and I really, really enjoyed it, and it kept me going for a long time, until the point that my anxiety began to get worse again, and I had to go to my GP, and we had to deal with that using other ways and means, and that's causing me a lot of problems now, but that's another story. But you know, it's at that point doing the service that I bumped into Steve. He strolled into a meeting one night, not in a great place, and I messaged him with my usual "Hi, welcome to the meeting," thinking he was a newcomer. And then he announced his clean time and pulled one over me again, as ever. And I thought, Jesus Christ, this guy needs to be bolted down to be doing some service here and a bit sharpish. He'd got some amazing clean time, far more than anybody else in the group had got. So it was great to meet him, and you know, I've learnt many things, and I've had, when I sit and listen to a lot of people share, I know that my recovery has not been as difficult as many. You know, I've been blessed in that respect. I've not had to deal with a lot of the shit that a lot of people in the rooms have had to deal with. I'm very lucky that I have an incredibly loving family. Without my sister and my mother, I would not be sat here. There is no two ways about that. My sister will drop everything. She's made it her business to learn as much as she can about addiction. She's made it her business to learn as much as she can about anxiety. She's made it her business to support and facilitate anything I wish to do with my recovery, to enable me to stay clean. She's a queen amongst diamonds. She really is. I don't know how she does it. And she's helped to carry me for a very long time. And now I'm as a result of my anxiety, I am sat here suffering from a withdrawal from a drug I took for a very long time at a do low dose that last year basically has been poisoning me. It's screwed up my salt levels spectacularly. I got blue lighted into hospital about 6 weeks ago, and I'm very much thrown myself back into my just for today's, and I've been listening to podcasts and things like that, because I am struggling at the minute. I'm not struggling with my sobriety, I'm just struggling with my bloody anxiety, and it's made for a painful Christmas. I'm actually glad today's over. It's not been an unpleasant day, but I'm glad it's done. I'm glad it's finished. So we can just go home and get on with things. It's not the Christmas that we had planned, that I had got planned in my head. It's my health's let me down, and it's going to be a long slog. But I know that behind me, I know that the tools that are in my box are tools that have got me this far and that will last me a lifetime. I have my recovery, and that is an incredibly strong tool to have. I have NA, and that's an incredibly strong tool to have. I have my beliefs in a higher power, and I have the things that I've learned and personally chosen to take away from the step work. And they are incredibly powerful tools to have on my side, because when I need them, I can pick out the one I need and use it. I've been talking for far too long, I think, possibly. It is great to be here. I'm deeply flattered that you asked me to be a guest speaker this evening, Steve. And I'm going to wish you all a very happy Christmas and a very peaceful 2022. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.